I'm Mikko Pawlikowski, and this is Hockey Stick. Generative AI is eating the world, just like software and the internet did before it. Probably everything you read and see today is at least in part generated or touched up by AI models. Revolutions tend to happen fast, but this one feels faster than anything I've seen before. Today, I'm joined by David Clinton, the author of the playfully named book The Complete Obsolete Guide to Generative AI. He's a serial author of technical books, including titles like Linux in Action, Linux Security Fundamentals, Ubuntu Linux Bible, AWS Study Guides, and more. When interrogated, he admitted to a dozen titles. In this conversation, we'll cover why Gen AI, not to be confused with Gen X, is such a big deal, why it's happening right now, what breakthroughs made it possible, and how you too can incorporate it in your life right now and become more productive right away. Welcome to this episode, and please enjoy. David, before I even met you, you've already given me a lot of trouble because for most of my guests, I can more or less describe them in three sentences. With you, on the other hand, I started looking up the books that you wrote and I can't even count them. And spoiler alert, David, I'm not sure he knows himself, because in one of the chapters of his book we're going to talk about, The Complete Obsolete Guide to Generative AI, he's asking ChatGPT to count the books that he's written, and ChatGPT doesn't know either. So David, how many books have you written at this stage?
It depends. Are you talking about the books under this name or under other names?
Oh, wow. Okay. Including your other alter egos.
Yeah, but at least the ones with my own name, David Clinton, various editions, maybe a dozen.
Linux in Action, Linux Security Fundamentals, Ubuntu Linux Bible, I think you co-authored that one. And there's a lot of study guides as well.
The Wiley study guides. By the way, being a Wiley author makes me a colleague of Herman Melville, the author of Moby Dick, because Herman Melville's publisher was John Wiley himself 200 years ago. The company somehow has survived 200 years, and the chairman is still a Wiley. It's Jesse Wiley now. It's absolutely amazing how they've survived and managed to adjust. There wasn't a lot of AWS training content necessary, required back in 1820. But they seem to have adjusted and found the new places. However, maybe near the end of this run, because one of the niches that generative AI is already eating is technology training books. Why buy a technology training book if GPT can tell you exactly what you want to know right now?
Well, so that's reason enough to go via Wiley. Did you prefer Wiley to Manning? What's your favorite publisher at this stage?
They're very different, and I like them both, each in their own way. Manning is very demanding from an editorial process perspective, and they take a long time on everything, a long time. That's why the book is called Obsolete. But they're good. They put out a great product. Wiley has a much lighter hand from an editorial perspective, and they have excellent connections in the industry as much as possible to move books in large numbers. And they're a solid, reliable company, but they each have their value and each have the things they do best.
Before I even opened the book, from the title, I got the hint that it was going to be a fun book, The Obsolete Guide. By the way, I'm still not sure how you passed that by the Manning editorial team.
Yeah,
how did they
me too. They loved it right away, actually. I was really surprised. I threw that out. I was angry with them. They were taking so long. So I just threw that title out and they actually bought it and they ran with it.
That's remarkable. So, why did you write this book? I read the book and you basically put in there a legend / myth about how they effectively told you to stop pestering them about using generative AI and just write a book about it already. Is that the short version of what happened?
It's close enough, as far as I can remember. We've had a good relationship for many years and they've sometimes asked me to do things I didn't want to do. And sometimes I pitched ideas to them they didn't want. This one, we were talking about on and off over a year. We were talking about generative AI in different contexts. And then they wanted to invest heavily in generative AI as far as their books and other content. They didn't want to get left behind, which is a very smart decision. So a year ago, they were looking at publishing 10, 15, 20 books in the general topic of generative AI. And they knew I was someone who thought a lot about it. So they were pushing me to do something. And I was pushing them to go away because I didn't think they could move fast enough for this particular market. somehow, I don't remember exactly how, but we latched on to this project. And so far, it's sold relatively well in its pre-meet sales, sold about 1,100 copies so far. And this is before it's published and before it hits Amazon. We can always hope. But I'm not disappointed. The process has been reasonable, if way too long.
Let's jump to the main question then. Why is generative AI such a big deal at the moment?
It's upending everything, almost everything. They're people who do things with their hands, who build the world and keep the world going. They're in an excellent position and they're still keeping the world going. But everybody else is at risk. But then again, 200 years ago, in the Industrial Revolution, we had the same fears that there are certain mechanical tools and processes were genuinely predicted and incorrectly predicted to be about to replace the vast majority of labor. And what would all those laborers do? But it actually worked out quite well. There wasn't mass starvation as a result of the Industrial Revolution. There are other issues, political issues, but not the Industrial Revolution issues. And the economy and the market somehow reached an equilibrium and settled. And as progress has been significant in the last 200 years, probably we're going to see something similar. There's going to be huge upheaval. Generative AI can do things that highly skilled people were necessary for 5 years ago and are no longer necessary. The things I do, I never truly understood why people bought my books like AWS Solutions Architect Study Guide. Where did they think I got my information for writing the book? I got it from the internet, right? Like everybody else. And if I could have gotten it from the internet, why doesn't everybody else? I'm not saying you shouldn't buy the book. Of course you should. But I just don't understand why. If you're just willing to invest a little bit of research time, you can get everything I got. I'm going to be replaced in at least that part of what I do. And it's scary for good reason. And it's exciting. And it is a big deal. I don't think much of the hype is oversold. This really is a big change.
When you were talking about construction site, I just remembered I saw the video on the internet and hopefully it's true and not AI generated, but it was basically a construction site with the scaffolding with a big banner on it saying ChatGPT finished this building.
They have experimented, I think, successfully already with print-on-demand houses, where they can actually layer after layer of a construction material to build the walls and even the ducting and some of the wiring for a house in a day.
It's interesting that you should mention that, because I think 3D printing, and I will include the housing printing in that category, held such a premise not that long ago, maybe a decade and a half ago, when we were picturing everybody printing anything, like in the sci-fi movies, when you just download something and then you click it and a minute later you get an object, physical object. People were talking about how it's going to be so dangerous because people can just download a plan for a gun and print it at home, or they can do replicas of things that will be indistinguishable from truth. But somehow that didn't really happen. What I actually see people printing is parts for their drones when they have to go through quite a lot of propellers when they're racing them, and the mandatory figurines that everybody prints when they actually buy a 3D printer initially, and not an awful lot more. So how do we know that? Why are we so sure, and that seems to be prevailing, that the AI revolution that we're seeing is different from that?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say that 3D printing is dead. You're right, it's dormant. But I think it is happening probably in niche areas where it's making a difference. They are printing 3D guns. They're just not advertising it because in many jurisdictions it's illegal. I think that's happening probably more than we'd like. So it's there and it'll find a niche. It'll probably find a market somehow. However, AI, I think, is different. That's not to say that it's going to play out exactly the way we think it will now, but markets will discover the value of AI in ways that probably we haven't anticipated. It's so broad and potentially complex, it won't be ignored. There are too many creative people and imaginative people who are focused on it now that I can't imagine that substantially transformative things won't happen. I can't tell you what they'll be necessarily, I can guess. But I can't believe that it won't happen. This is a tool that's far too valuable to be ignored. But hey, I've been wrong before. In fact, if you ever want to know how to anticipate the results of an election, just ask me what I think, who I think is going to win, and go the other way, because I'm always wrong in my predictions.
So you hinted a little bit at one group of people that you expect to be particularly affected, and you included yourself in the technical writing. And I think to a certain extent, I'm ready to agree with you. Probably the ChatGPT version of technical documentation is going to be equally dry as the majority of the documentation that I come across myself. Who else is at the highest end of the possible affection of their livelihoods effectively?
I wouldn't want to be a young accountant. What accountants do is easily replicable by AI right now, and certainly in the next few years. They mentally process a lot of numbers and trends. And of course, there are a lot of accountants. Different accountants do different things. They have different tasks. But at core, they're processing data, whether it's financial data or sales data. And they are trying to, number one, organize it so that they can file their quarterly filings and their tax filings and everything. So they're trying to organize the information. But also the higher level accountants are anticipating where these trends are going to affect their company, the company they're working for. And those are things that AI does exceptionally well already and is only going to get better. And when the time comes that they'll be integrating accounting processes into AI systems, I think accountants will be looking for new work. Another thing, I read an article last week by the owner of a small Canadian publisher, Sutherland House. He wrote about a conference of publishers he was at sometime before, and they had an AI specialist, whatever that is, I guess that's me, I don't know, and talking about how their industry was going to be changed. And they spoke about things like AI translation. This publisher likes the idea of taking excellent European books or books from all over the world that aren't written in English and have proven themselves as popular and successful books in their languages. But he said that translating them is expensive. Hiring a good literary translator is not cheap, and it's not cost effective in his publishing model. But feeding the manuscript to an AI translator will get you 80% of the way there. And then you hire a genuine human translator to fix it, to get the last 20%, but it's going to be much cheaper. So those are things that are changing. But the AI specialist at this conference then said one thing. He said, you can say goodbye to all your interns. And then the crowd, apparently the audience started screaming and shouting, and that upset a lot of people. But it's probably true. An intern at a publishing company, their job is to make all the connections and do all the grunt work that the executives don't want to do or haven't got the time to do. And that's exactly the type of work, the moving information, making appointments, making connections. That's exactly the sort of work that an AI can do well or will be able to do well soon enough. So that junior knowledge worker is at risk. Of course, the problem there is that the new talent comes into the publishing world through the interns. They get interns fresh out of college and they train them up. They get them to the point where they're capable of doing bigger things. And if you wipe out the intern program, then you're wiping out your feed of new talent. That's disruptive. But how could a publishing company justify, or a government for that matter, justify hiring hundreds or thousands of junior managers if that can all be replaced with software?
Let me challenge you a little bit on two aspects of that. First of all, it's not particularly difficult to get any of these models really to trip on basic arithmetics. Like, it's gotten a little bit better now with GPT-4 that actually uses a calculator instead of trying to do the arithmetics in its head. But it's still not particularly hard to formulate it in a way that it doesn't trigger that and gives you a demonstrably false answer. I think you gave a few examples of that from prior versions in the book as well, when you were asking about a population that's the closest to the median list.
I can't remember. Yeah, it's been a long time since I wrote it, but you're right. Definitely there have been problems. Yeah.
So that makes me think that this is still better suited for situations where you've got a lot of groundwork, like you said, the translation, for example. You can get it to be 90% good, and then get someone to do the last 10%, and you save yourself 90% of the cost. Great. But Is that going to work the same with the accounting? Can you get the accounts to be 90% good and then get someone to check the last 10%?
Possibly. I don't see why not. They do have auditors for a reason, and they can just adjust the role of your company auditor to be looking over the shoulder of the AI rather than all the junior accountants. Possibly. It's hard to know how it'll play out. But also, as far as the errors go, GPT and other AIs are prone to certain types of errors, and they're working on them. But my experience with, let's say, I feed now really large spreadsheets and 400-page corporate filings, I'll feed them to GPT, and I'll get into look for anomalies and add up all the line items related to this issue or that issue, basically doing SQL requests on it. It's very good. And then I'll usually check it up. I'll usually confirm. I'll load it up into Python and Pandas and do my own searches. And recently, it's been pretty much always right. I think the hallucinations are disappearing. They've probably not gone completely. And we're going to have fun still. But I think they've turned a corner, I think, in that field. With the exception, of course, of Google Gemini, which is a complete and utter disaster because they knew what they were doing. Everything I've read from insiders, they knew exactly what they were building with Gemini. It was a political indoctrination tool, and it was not there to aid humans, but to guide humans. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but it wasn't what they advertised it as. And I think at this point still, Gemini is pretty much unreliable for anything serious. But we've discovered that. Maybe it would be true of other engines also. And maybe in time we'll show that we were too harsh on Gemini. But at least at this point, if I could back up a bit, 10 years ago, I was involved with some startups. And there's something about the startup culture that I really appreciated. I thought was very positive. When a customer would leave, an angry customer would leave, or an angry employee would leave, very often the startup culture meant that they would beg the customer or the employee, tell us what we did wrong. You're leaving, fine. We're sorry to see you go. Wish you the best. But just tell us what we did wrong. We want to improve. And I saw this more than once. CEOs would send email blasts to the whole company. This is a problem somebody just reported. I want it fixed in 48 hours. They loved to hear criticism. They wanted to improve. It was a culture of openness. And it's all about money, of course. But okay, what's wrong with incentives? There was a real culture of change. I think a lot of startups from 20 years ago, like Google, have lost that. Whether they want it or not, they can't do it. They're so ossified. They're so big. They're so impenetrable and they're so enslaved to processes that they can't change even if they wanted to. And they couldn't really genuinely hear criticism even if they wanted to. It's a shame. I think it's probably a natural process of all organizations. You know how governments work. The large organizations are very hard to improve when things go wrong. But it's a shame that to some degree we've lost that culture. And I think that leads to huge mistakes, like Gemini. There will be a shaking out of the industry, that some will do better than others. So some AIs are going to improve and probably become steadily more and more astounding, and some aren't. And it's be interesting to see which.
Google is such an interesting topic, and you're obviously not the only one person saying that. I've read at this stage dozens of former employees or even current employees complaining about the same thing, that it's by no means anymore a startup, and that's to a certain extent normal. Their size, their influence. People complain about the same things, like them killing projects and replacing them with the same thing and renaming and rebranding and completely not listening to customers. But I think that Gemini or in general, the AI situation at Google is so interesting because they were at the forefront of that. They spent a lot of money acquiring researchers, acquiring assets. They were there from the ground up.
It's wild. And it reminds me of Kodak. Kodak owned photography for almost a century, I don't know, 60, 70 years. And they worked on digital photography. They didn't ignore it. I think they built one of the first digital cameras. They were certainly in the first few. And they did not ignore the technology, but somehow they couldn't pivot. And they just didn't build a product that the market wanted. And where's Kodak now? So Google's sitting on a lot of cash right now. They invested probably more than anyone in AI and probably did groundbreaking work, which we're using now. But where are they?
And there are other companies that are by no means startups and they don't move very fast. But for example, at this stage, at least, Microsoft's investments seem so much better in that respect. They basically more or less bought themselves OpenAI by the accounts of many people. And they're integrating that like crazy into everything at the moment. And where were they when Google was investing that a decade ago? There is this document, internal memo, that I don't think we still know who wrote that. It leaked about a year ago, and it was called something around, "We have no moat, and neither does OpenAI." And I think the points that they were raising in there, whoever wrote that, are, they basically materialized 100%. They were talking about how all the things that Google is planning and hoping to achieve, like running the LLMs on your phone, that's already happening. Things like scaling multimodality. Today, this is all over the place, but the open source picked it up and ran with it. And obviously, a big part of that is Facebook leaking accidentally their model to, at least in my version of events, to undermine a little bit the hegemony potentially and give people alternative, but the open source models just run away with that and there's no going back. And then things like cheap fine tuning with LoRa and later QLoRA, all of those things are making it even more so than that prophetic memo announced a year ago. And I just found it crazy that you can waste your initial advantage so badly.
Although it's interesting that I don't have the sense that there's a huge uptake on truly open source and private LLMs. I'm not sure how many people are doing it for themselves. Yeah, of course, NVIDIA is selling a lot of GPUs to the people who are doing this in their houses. But I still see OpenAI and perhaps Anthropic are still attracting a lot of customers. And I have no numbers, but I suspect they have a large majority of the market for generative AI is going through those portals rather than people doing it on their own. So while it is available, there are LLMs you can build on your own, I'm not sure how popular it is.
I remember a study that was querying people about how many models they're using. And I think the most popular answer was either two or three different models. And one of them was OpenAI and one of them was local. And I think the local, it's easy to picture people hacking away in their garages and kind of movie style Hollywood hacker kind of thing. But what I think is actually happening is that in addition to using OpenAI's models primarily, because they still got the biggest chunk of the market to do the kind of workhorse thing and get projects started to get something off the ground quickly, people are at least looking and investing into getting something that they have some kind of control over. And you can pick like a mixed role, you can pick even a Llama. And if you're using that for a particular use case that you can test to an extent that is actually feasible at the moment, and you can look into how it's behaving on your data, on your hardware, that gives you a massive advantage. Like nobody can pull a rug from under you. You download that, and initially the licenses were a little bit funny and you had to apply and do things like that. But now a lot of those models are Apache 2.0. I think it's not necessarily a question of either or, it's more of different use cases make some of those options preferable. If I was starting a startup and I wanted to get something off the line very quickly, it's like an obvious choice to get one of the APIs, pay a few cents per 1,000 tokens and get it off. But as soon as you would like to make it a permanent feature and have any control, I think the local models really hold a lot of promise. We'll see, obviously, where it goes, but I think that's how I would describe it today. Jumping back to my second challenge to you, I wanted to compare the generative AI that we're seeing today to self-driving cars. And I think I remember the self-driving wars of, what was it, mid-2010s, when they were offering researchers multi-million dollar packages and stealing research from each other and Waymo and Uber and everybody. they got it to a point where it was like 90-something% good, but that wasn't enough, right? It has to be effectively superhuman quality for people to get over the fact that there's no one behind the wheel. Why do we think that generative AI is not going to suffer from the same problem?
First of all, sometimes the stakes aren't as high. With a self-driving car, you could be killing people if you make a mistake. And that's definitely a threshold you don't want to slip underneath. Whereas generative AI, a lot of it, maybe most of it, is just, okay, so it gets a little math wrong, it's not going to kill anyone. That may be part of it. The second thing is that generative AI is coming at us from so many different directions, and only one has to succeed and become the next killer app or whatever. Whereas self-driving cars are self-driving cars. That's all they do. And you either succeed as a self-driving car or you don't. By the way, I think self-driving cars are probably going to make it, and they are still making progress. I think in Las Vegas, they now have the Waymo taxis are actually on the street running in real time, I think. And so that is eventually going to happen. Of course, 6-7 years ago, they were predicting that all transport trucks would be driverless by the year 2020 or whatever. But then again, having said that, when I was in high school, my geography teacher told us about the Club of Rome predictions. This is, by the way, back in the late 70s. So the Club of Rome predicted that the world would run out of gold and platinum by the late 1980s and would run out of petroleum by like a 1990 or so and would run out of food by about 1995. I guess that didn't happen. Maybe some of these predictions aren't to be taken that seriously either. I do think that generative AI has a much better chance of pushing through obstacles simply because there's so many ways it could go. And there's so many possible happy endings.
Would you venture your best bet of what's going to be the real killer app coming first?
I would say that Google, with their lack of a moat, is a good target in the sense that internet search may disappear as a business model and as a use case, simply because augmented AI search is probably going to be better. The last 3-4 months, I think I've had a ChatGPT Plus subscription. I bit the bullet and did it, and I'm happy I did because it's pretty amazing. So when I ask ChatGPT Plus to find some current information, it'll activate Bing and go search. So that's only going to get better. And with the power of AI itself married to the ability to search under the hood, the entire internet, why do I need Google search anymore? A search engine has been the way we organize the world for the last 15 years, 20 years, I don't know. And it's the way we think. When you go to the internet, your thought was, let's go to a search engine and get there that way. It may not be rational to use that in a year or so. So I would say that would be a big upheaval, because it's not just Google that's going to be a victim of this. Every person who's ever optimized his website for SEO, that advantage will disappear.
Yeah.
That'll be hugely disrupting.
Certainly.
I wouldn't even know how to approach building a website anymore, because your mind is set. You optimize for SEO, but maybe not.
Yeah, it's crazy to think how much we rely on Google. So many people rely on their SEO for their livelihoods. And like you said, obviously you have to optimize for SEO, otherwise nobody will find you. So you have no traffic, so you earn no money. Last time I checked, or I vaguely remember, I think about 80% of Google's income was still coming from ads. And lately, I don't know if it's just me thinking about it more than before, but I started noticing that most of my first page, it's basically ads at this moment. So I do wonder at the back of my head if they just assumed that was going to die, so they have to like ramp up and make as much money as possible right now.
Squeeze whatever they can out. Maybe.
Have you tried?
It's scary.
Yeah.
It's scary for them, and it's scary for everyone who relied on ads.
Yes. The rudimentary version of that, you can use like ChatGPT or Premium or whatever. There is a thing I've tried called Perplexity. Full disclosure, no connection to them whatsoever. How did you find that?
As far as simple questions, code, if I ask for code or if I ask for a thinking question, it's been close. It was close to GPT. I haven't used it for a couple months regularly, but I was impressed. It didn't have the extra functionality of GPT Plus, So you couldn't upload a document and, yeah. and have it analyze the document. But as far as just talking with it, it was fairly close, as is Claude by Anthropic. For some reason in Canada, they didn't fully release it even yet completely. But that much Claude I'm allowed to use in Canada, I found it to be definitely comparable to GPT.
I don't know how you feel about Elon Musk, but have you tried Grok and the XAI?
No, I haven't tried it yet. By the way, I love watching Elon Musk. He's so much fun. And the guy is controversial. He's crazy. But that's all part of the fun, right? I mean, he's done things with SpaceX that are just so exciting. If what every nerdy kid would have wanted to become, he's doing it. He's living the life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So now when I test a new chatbot, I'm bored very quickly because I've talked to them to death before. But Grok is differentiated by being the opposite of safe and boring. So you can get it to say a lot of things very easily. And even when you try, it's not going to give you like this boring, dry answer, which is at the very minimum refreshing. And they actually open sourced the model recently on what seemed like Elon Musk's complete whim one day to look better than OpenAI.
Well, what a surprise. Who saw that coming? That Elon Musk would have a whim.
From what I remember, it's a mixture of experts' architecture that was 300 and I want to say 20 or 40 billion parameters. So despite being only 25% weight active at a time, you're still not going to be able to run it on anything anybody has at home. But you can talk to that if you've got X premium or whatever, if you give Elon Musk money, which is an interesting side quest. Which also reminds me, speaking of Elon Musk, I think another whim, on the 8th of August, we're supposed to see the robotaxi. The speculation is that he was working on Model 2 or whatever the cheapest version of Tesla is supposed to be. And he internally killed it to push for the self-driving taxi that doesn't even have a steering wheel or anything like that. And then Reuters wrote something about how that model was dead based on people's leaked opinions. He called them liars, something happened, and then next day is, oh, we're going to unveil Robotaxi in a couple of months. So trademark Musk PR version, but I am curious whether it's going to be vaporware or whether we're going to see anything substantial.
With his track record, the odds are pretty good. Of course, yeah, you have to be careful where you tell it to take you because you may end up on Mars or something.
I guess the caveat to that is that the track record of delivery, yes, but the track record of timelines is usually a few years skewed, but we'll see. Anyway, before I get asked to go on a grand tour of the different use cases that you discuss in your book, and I think a lot of people might find it valuable and they'll just go and buy your book right away, I wanted to also touch base very quickly on why it's all happening now, because a lot of these ideas, if not all of them, are decades old. What happened? Why is it happening now? Is it all thanks to gamers and crypto miners?
Partly. It's certainly technology gains have been significant in the last 5 years. And Moore's Law is always shaky. It's about to break because we're moving too fast. But I think the big thing is integration, that whereas 3-4 years ago, you could do image segmentation, let's say, using a deep learning model. You could do it 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, probably. But it was a discrete tool. You could use it for that and only that, and don't try to integrate it with anything else. What's happened now is that we can integrate, let's say, the entire internet with the generative AI model and an engine, and then integrate that with the way you work and think. So I can talk to it, I can type to it, I could plug it into my company and its workflow and have it manage things for me. I think that's a big deal. We're starting to see, I guess, the first stages of AI agents, which is, it's going to push this a lot further, I would imagine. I ask an AI a question about my business. I want to launch a Twitter campaign to promote my new product. And so it'll tell me how to do it, but I say, be my agent, now go do it. And people have done this already, actually. People have connected Twitter accounts to GPT and actually had it manage their social media. Probably a huge improvement in most cases over the real thing, but I don't know. There's an accident, you make a claim to your car insurance company. the AI could manage the insurance processing. It'll contact the underwriter and it'll collect all the details of the accident and what the insured property was and send those to the underwriter. And the underwriter will send back an answer and it'll go to the bank. And it could actually handle complex processes independently and reliably, at some point reliably at any rate. So this integration and then the next step integration with creating agents, I think it has been a big game changer. It's taken a lot of discrete technologies and brought them together into something a whole lot bigger.
Would you say that the data sets available also played a role?
Sure. Yeah. And not only have they been getting, taken as one of the projects I'm involved, it would seem on the surface to be really unrelated to anything I've done before. I have a Substack called The Audit, where I write about policy analysis in Canadian politics. It's not something most people, even in Canada, are interested in, and certainly not outside Canada. But the underlying premise of the site and of almost everything I write there is that governments and institutions make an amazing amounts of that data freely available. So almost everything that goes on in Canada's parliament has always been recorded in a document called Hansard. But now it's all available, not only available online in digital format, but it's now sadly JSON rather than CSV mostly, but it's available in a format that you can actually work with and you could do a deep data analysis with it. So governments at all levels, all over the world almost, are producing a ton of data, as are various types of institutions. And that data is all becoming available, through APIs and in automated context. So yes, that has made a huge difference and it's going to make a much, much bigger difference the further we go on this line.
I think there is also a slightly more nefarious or I guess gray area to that, which is exemplified in this massive lawsuit against OpenAI from the New York Times, I think, that alleges that they should be compensated for the demonstrable fact that their model that's bringing them billions of dollars was actually trained on the body of work that they've accumulated over decades. It's interesting because it seems to be very divisive. A lot of people say, oh, if I read the articles and I write something, you're not going to chase me, which is fair. A lot of them say that if we allow OpenAI to go with that and then the next ones can't do that, they get unfair advantage. There's a lot of facets to that. And I'm curious personally which way is going to sway. A lot of people don't like the copyright law right away, which is also understandable. But I am curious how that's going to play out, whether going forward things will continue getting more open or whether it's going to be the opposite. Because even before the ChatGPT revolution, I want to say, places like Reddit, for example, were guarding what effectively is their IP from Google because they don't want Google to serve you ads and get paid for that. They'd rather you came onto their platform and clicked on their ads to prop their business. Do you have a firm opinion whether which way you expect this to go?
These are tough questions, obviously. I appreciate copyright protections. I'm a writer and I create courses and I create books and content and I appreciate being protected. And if I wasn't protected, arguably I wouldn't be able to write and create this content. In my particular case, that probably wouldn't be true because thousands of people have copies of my books illegally on the dark web. And it doesn't really hurt my business that much because my customers buy through normal channels and it's really hard to market my stuff illegally. But nonetheless, creators should be protected because they have to be incentivized to create. On the other hand, there's only a certain distance you can push that. I've heard the argument in the New York Times case that New York Times authors generally learn to write by reading Ernest Hemingway. Does that mean that the Ernest Hemingway estate has a claim against the New York Times writers for a portion of their intellectual property? No one's going to say that. When it's a question of training, if it was taking content or taking ideas, okay, that's would seem to be a clear copyright violation. But when it's a question of training, I've heard the argument that that's not a violation. Everybody trains on something. The whole purpose of content is to train people how to read and write and think. And of course, we want people to learn from us. And of course, you expect that and you can't prevent that. If you're going to put something in the public domain, you have to expect that people are going to use it. So these are tough questions. It's going to be hard to find a balance. I don't know how it's going to play out. The odds are technology will probably win. I have never seen technology lose, for better or for worse. I guess we have seen technology lose. And you think of the nuclear energy industry, it lost in a lot of countries like Germany. The nuclear energy genuinely has produced the carbon neutral energy, extensive but clean energy for decades and decades. There have been a few accidents, tragically, but by and large, the energy has been clean, relatively affordable, and has many upsides and no downsides. And yet, the technology has been rejected in certain jurisdictions. So I guess technology can lose, but by and large, it doesn't. So if I would have to bet money, I would bet against the New York Times. I would bet with technology prevailing. In other words, the use of AI expanding.
I like both your example and your counterexample. And it's probably because I've been watching on Netflix Lincoln Lawyer for the last couple of evenings.
Okay.
So yeah. I want to say it also has to win in the court of public opinion. Yeah. And that might actually be more tricky than anything else. The point that you make in your book about open research on that and how that accelerated this. There's been obviously open research by some people who strongly believe that in that. There was research behind a closed door. But would you like to describe briefly what you meant in the book when you said that this Cambrian explosion of generative AI that we're looking at right now was in part made possible by the open nature of research?
As I think Linus Torvalds said, in the context of open source software, many eyes make problems lighter. That is, the more people who are reviewing your research and trying to replicate your research, the greater the chance you're going to find problems faster and improve things better and faster. That was the premise of peer-reviewed medical studies, which of course is apparently how it's collapsed and is in complete shambles now. But in the open source world, and particularly in a lot of the early research into AI, there was a spirit of collaboration, and much of what was created was put into the public domain and was shared and commented on and improved as a result. And there was a lot of money invested, but there were an awful lot of people involved in the research. And there, as far as I understand, I have to be careful what I say. I can't talk about too many details, one, because I'm ignorant, and two, because someone, actual pioneer in the AI research world, read my book, The Obsolete Guide to Generative AI. Manning thought it was a good idea to send it to him just to see what he thought. And the appendix at the end, which also includes a brief history of the AI developments, he really didn't like. And he felt that I had misrepresented a lot of the pioneers and the specific processes in advancing various AI technologies one step at a time. He felt I got it all wrong. He was an insider. He was involved in a lot of the original research. So the problem is, he's probably right. He's probably a lot more accurate than I am. I'm not 100% sure how to take it, though. This was a complex history with personalities, and sometimes personalities didn't get along well with each other. This is the academic world, after all, where you can't become a great academic unless you don't get along well with people, it seems. So I'm not going to go into any detail about how exactly it happened and who were the big movers and shakers, but it did happen, and a lot of it was done in an open collaborative format.
So are you going to keep the brief history in the appendix, or are you going to amend it?
We are updating it, because again, he has a lot of credibility.
From your description, there's probably about five people, the set that I could place in that room. I'm curious. But let's leave it at that. I promised people a little bit earlier that we'd go through a little tour of the different use cases. For anybody who's going to now go and put the money on Manning's website to receive goods in exchange, the book is very hands-on. It doesn't waste too much time explaining how these things work under the hood. It goes more into, oh, here's how you play with it, here's what you can do, let your imagination run, go crazy, it will help you become more productive the way that it did to the author. If we were to pick maybe three or five most favorite examples of you that you covered there that you think provide the best bang for your buck experience, which ones would you go with?
I'd say the one that excited me the most when I did it was using the tool called AutoGPT. That was an API tool where you had the OpenAI API tool, a key, and you would feed the tool with a set of detailed instructions. I want you to go out, research this on the internet, then take the outcome and distill it this way, and then I want you to draw a conclusion about this and calculate that. You gave the detailed instructions. It would go out and search the internet, get information, gather it, come back and iterate over many steps, give you an answer. That was really exciting. The downside is it was a complete failure. The technology, as far as I know, more often than not, it just goes into these death spirals. It loops over and over again, the same iteration over and over, and never stops, just keep costing you more money. However, the few times I actually did get it to work, I was considering whether to create a course on Udemy on a particular LPI, Linux Professional Institute certification that was relatively new. And I wanted to know, how popular is that certification? How likely is it that users are going to want to buy my course and then take that certification? So I had it go out and research the popularity based on social media posts and based on internet evidence, assess the popularity of this technology versus three other technologies, which I knew how popular they were. I had a good sense of how effective they were. And it spent 45 minutes or so and about $2 of my money or something like that, and came back with a coherent and a numeric answer. I said, you know, on a scale of 1 to 100, how would you rate the popularity of each of these four technologies or these four certifications? And it came back with a good answer. It may even have been correct. So I thought that was fantastic. That's going to change the world. It may change the world, but it won't be AutoGPT that does it. But yes, that's a type of agent that I think has a lot of potential. I'm not sure exactly whether they'll get it right, but someone's going to get that right. And I have to say, I'm not impressed with the AI music and video yet. Everyone else seems to be, but we have 300 years of all the world's music on Spotify available 24/7, right? Do you really think that AI is going to make something better? They may make good stuff, but there are millions of pieces of music that I've never listened to that are probably excellent, probably outstanding, but I just don't need enough time. So do we really need more music, even if it is good? And what makes good music? I don't know. So AI music, I'm absolutely not impressed with yet.
Okay. AI, everybody skip the music chapter.
It was just a music paragraph, actually, if I remember correctly. There's just one paragraph. AI video, the OpenAI tool Sora, which is producing these 30-second clips of video, also, it's ho-hum. I don't know. They're obviously AI. They're nice. They're visually attractive, but show me something with a little more substance. I'm really not there yet, but who knows? Things change. AI voices, by the way, voice cloning is something that a number of companies have been offering for quite some time. And OpenAI just announced they have their new voice cloning tool. From 10 seconds of your recorded voice, they can then reproduce your voice reading anything. No one's shown it to me yet. I'll believe it when I see it. In other words, can they produce voice that won't be recognizably machine?
I think that's a very high bar because so much goes into this little hands and the tempo and everything. But I do think that there's been a massive improvement in that. You can listen to that. You're not going to be fooled into thinking that it's a real person, but your ears are not going to fall off at the end of it. There's a lot of websites that integrate that to have the audio instead of reading through a longer article. And I find myself using that a little bit more than I did before. For example, if I need to do something else, I can just put it on and listen to the article. A little bit if it was a podcast episode. However, that's not going to fool me. I think that transcription, on the other hand, is getting closer to basically as good as it's going to get. Because we're using that in a couple of projects. For example, my brother and I, we ran a series of technical conferences. And people submit their talks, and it's a lot of subscriptions to make. We initially tried to get them done by hand, and that was just not going to happen. We integrated that with Assembly AI right now, and it's about 90, I don't know, maybe 5% good, to the point that the things that it doesn't get very well sometimes is things like names of things, but it's good enough that mostly you can ignore the mistakes at this stage. So I think that's going pretty good. On the image and video thing, I think I would agree that people started talking about how Hollywood was going to fall because Sora could generate 30 seconds of a coherent image. There was a lot of excitement about that. There was a project called Pika Labs, I think, before that, and that also could generate 30 seconds or something like that. Some of them looked funny. Some of them looked like a very low budget animation from the 2000s. And some of them just looked rubbish. But the one exception to that, I think, is I remember when I went back to using Midjourney after I initially tried it and wasn't impressed, I just started like killing it. I think it might have been about a year ago or something like that. I went back and I started generating some images. I was just so impressed how good they were. They had all the fingers and no additional
arms.
Right
number of fingers.
Yeah, and the faces. And people started coming up with these tricks on how to generate like consistent faces if you wanted to generate multiple pictures of your character. I think it comes out of the box with that now. For everybody I talked to, replaced stock images. Like instead of going and paying for a stock image, you can get a custom one and you can ask it to tweak it until you like it. And so for this, like going back to what you said, generative AI versus self-driving cars, when the stakes are lower and you can accept some problems, it's working well enough that it's just replacing that. In terms of music, that's a little awkward. All of the music for this podcast is AI generated.
It can be good. I probably won't listen to the music of this podcast hours and hours on end.
Oh yeah, it's about 15 seconds, so you should be okay.
Yeah, okay. So for that purpose, it's great. But I don't think it's going to replace people's playlists.
No, I don't think so, unless you're talking about the actual playlist algorithm, because I think Spotify has been very loud about how they're going to replace your playlist and basically get AI to find the songs that they think you're going to like. Facebook or whatever social media is keeping you algorithmically hooked to that. And that, I believe, they might be onto something. There's probably an optimal algorithm that can get you hooked and addicted to as many songs as possible. There's also that. For anybody else who wants to get the nitty-gritty of how to actually play with all these things and test it for yourselves, there is a sequence of chapters on all of these things and more, including as well as what we covered, things like code and talking to documents. I think there is a little example where David is getting some kind of AI to talk to a PDF containing Tesla's financial reports.
Yeah.
And it's actually working very well. So there's that.
Yeah, it's gotten a lot better since, especially with the GPT Plus. A lot of barriers have fallen. With my writing from the audit site, I'm able to do things in an hour that a traditional journalist would have taken a week or two if you could do it at all. But I'm doing it because of GPT's incredible processing powers.
Yeah. Thank you, gamers. If it wasn't for you, yeah, we have never gotten NVIDIA to make all those GPUs. As you can probably imagine, I'm not going to let you off the hook before I try to squeeze your wild prediction about things like AGI and things like regulation, and things like quantum computing and where you think that is going. So maybe let's just bite a bullet and go there. AGI.
I'm not sure exactly how we all measure it, because there's so many things that GPT, for instance, does so much better than I could ever do and faster. Big Blue beat Kasparov in chess, right? So that was one discrete task, which is a very complicated task. That's already 20 years older, somewhere in that area. Okay. But there are many things that GPT can do infinitely faster than I can. Is that AGI yet? I'm not sure how we define it. I think it's inevitable. My humble opinion is that AGI, if not now, certainly in the next couple of years, I would imagine is inevitable. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Personally, I don't stay up at night worrying about the AGI apocalypse, that the AI is going to push off the shackles of humanity and take over and destroy us all. But hey, who knows? In any case, betting against it's not going to make any money because you won't be here to collect. So as far as AGI, I think it's inevitable, if not now, soon. As far as quantum computing, I've read some about quantum computing. I know that I have a very vague understanding of what makes it different and how it'll be so compute intensive It could be that quantum computing will solve the energy problem that AI is facing. Maybe. That is, platforms like OpenAI require thousands of CPUs chugging away in data centers, and some of them require their own nuclear energy generators just to keep them alive. There isn't enough electricity in the world being generated to keep this stuff running. And of course, they're adding on electric cars that are all supposed to be fed from the electrical grid, and there isn't enough electricity. Well, the chairman of Toyota and Elon Musk also both warned that if every car sold in 2030 is an EV, we are not going to have enough electricity to run it and to power your shaver. There isn't enough. So we're coming to a crisis probably soon. Quantum computing, if it scales up fast enough, might be more efficient from an energy perspective and might head off that crisis, that they'll still be able to exponentially grow the compute base of these platforms and have enough energy to feed them. Possibly. That's a complete guess, and don't take it at all seriously, but it's possible. The downside, the real downside of quantum computing, of course, is that all our passwords will be assumed to be broken, because the RSA algorithm will probably be cracked fairly quickly once quantum computing becomes commercial. If someone had penetrated your private website or your private data 2-3 years ago and saved the data archives, unable to get to it because it's encrypted, because of course you use good passwords. But once the quantum computing allows us to crack the RSA algorithm, they can retroactively access everything that they've saved, because it's all behind an encryption that can be broken, that it has or will have been broken. Okay, that's a possibility. As far as regulation goes, as I wrote in the book, I believe this can't be regulated. Governments can jump up and down and kick and scream, as they always do, and pass legislation that severely restricts the developments in AI. It's not going to change much, because it's out in the open. It's out in the wild. People will do with it what they want. The market will do with it what it wants. Some have argued, as you probably read, OpenAI's requests for government regulation might just be a subtle attempt at locking in the market. Since it's on top, once the market is regulated, no one else will be able to enter the market. Once they're on top, they'll stay on top. So some have interpreted it that way, as I'm sure you've probably read. But I don't think it's practical. Some things can't be regulated.
Wouldn't be the first time. I remember a certain Zuckerberg pleading a very similar case. Fair enough. I wanted to do one more thing before I let you off the hook. I found your chapter, I think it was chapter 11, where you presumably got some friends who happen to be experts in AI, and you asked them a series of interesting questions, like what were the problems, what were the biggest surprises, what do you actually use the most, and all of that. What were the biggest unexpected items that you saw them? You know, you obviously went with some presumptions of what you were going to see there. I'm curious what you got that you didn't sign up for.
That's an interesting question. And sadly, I can't remember the details well enough. I appreciate it. I do. The answers were great. And it added a lot to the book, I think. But sadly, I can't remember them in detail. I have to say that I was expecting some more embarrassing step on a rake incidents than I got, because I've had plenty of step on the rake incidents myself. Oh, I'll tell you an example. I'll come out in the open and tell you one of my, I guess you can call it a failure, but it was an experiment early on when, possibly before GPT-3 came out. I started with OpenAI. I believe it was still GPT-2. I'm not sure they called it that, but I don't remember now, but it was before GPT-3, right at the very beginning. I experimented to see how it would generate written content, technology content. So I conversed with it back and forth and got from it the content for 5 books. One was on low code, another was on a couple of security topics that I don't even remember. And I assembled all the content and I edited it to give it some coherence and give it a narrative and a flow. And I published them. And I just want to see what would happen. Can I effectively, in 2 hours, I went from zero to up on Amazon Kindle. I wanted to see if there was a business model. So first of all, I'm not the only one who had that thought, right? So Amazon is now flooded with literally millions of such books. And most of them are trash. And most of them you can tell pretty quickly are trash, and people avoid them, and the market is correcting for that. Amazon asks you now, whenever you upload a new book to Kindle, they ask you, was this or was all or most of this book generated by an AI? So they want to know. They're not penalizing you yet, but they want to know. And it's a fair question. These four or five books, I did publish them. I'm not embarrassed by them because I think the content is useful and helpful. I think it's genuinely helpful content. I read through it all. I don't think there are any mistakes there. I don't think there's anything misleading there, but it's cheap. it's not something I'm particularly proud of, but I did it. It was an experiment, and I think the whole thing took me 2 weeks, all five books.
Tempting and interesting. So they ask whether 50% or more of the book was generated.
Something like that. It was a substantial amount of the book generated by AI. Maybe the word they use is substantial. I don't remember. They're facing this problem. They have to figure out a way to deal with it. Their platform is being flooded with this garbage.
Yeah. Although even with legitimate books, I would expect that very close to 100% has some percentage that was at least rephrased.
You have to be crazy not to. It can make you so much more efficient and more accurate as long as you use it carefully and as long as you don't abuse it. Some of my book, The Obsolete Guide to Generative AI, 10% maybe, 20%, I don't know, is AI generated.
A good path to doing your revisions. You just regenerate the book with a newer AI.
Yeah, well, that's possible. Actually, Manning and I were talking about that. A lot of their authors are not English as first language. They're foreign language speakers primarily. Great technologists, good authors, but English is not their first language. So they have a lot of problems sometimes getting a manuscript from the author's computer to a publishable state in English. And they'll invest a lot of money in that sometimes. So they wondered, and we were playing around with the idea of feeding chapter by chapter into GPT and then getting it to revise the book, to rewrite the chapter in. I don't know if they ever used it. I gave them a couple of proof of concept experiments. I'm not sure they ever actually applied it or not, but it's an interesting idea, certainly.
At this rate, we're just going to end up with everything touched or rephrased or rewritten by AI. Going back to what you said about SEO, there are so many people really banking on spitting out so much content, generating entire websites just to capture some of the traffic with AI, which sadly means that the era of someone having a website about something that they're interested in and that being found is just gone by now, I think.
And how that's going to fall out, I don't know what's going to happen to the accessibility of the internet. That I don't want to predict.
Yeah, and it's weird. When I speak to different people, I feel very different. For example, I was speaking to a friend and about how people rewrite their text with ChatGPT, and technically they wrote it, but not really. Yeah, it's generated by AI. Almost exactly what you were describing about getting a chapter and getting it to be more English first language. And the argument was, would you also tell me to not use autocorrect or like a dictionary? Because that's right. Cheating, which kind of shut me up. And I've used that argument since on the other side. And that made me feel, okay, that's probably a silly argument. But then on the other hand, I wonder if people who sell cars and they were like, oh, no, we like our horses, and what's going to happen to all these horses? And no, this is cheating. It runs on petrol. It doesn't even have to stop and drink water. Whether I'm one of those people sometimes when I speak to my friends. It's weird times we're in, isn't it?
Yeah. Thinking back 10 years to how workday went and the tools I'd use. And my first book I wrote 35 years ago was probably before you were born, possibly. I wrote it, as I mentioned somewhere, I wrote it on paper with a pen. And you write differently. When I wrote on a typewriter, you write differently because there's no correct. Forget about autocorrect. There's no correct at all. So you're stuck with the version you have. Okay, you use that, what was it called? You probably don't remember. They used to have this correctotype, I think it was called, a little tool you could add little white ink over a mistake in a typewriter. It was kludgy, and you just had to get it right the first time. I've seen it around the time that word processors became popular 25 years ago. Some editors, one editor in particular, said that she can always tell a manuscript that was written on a computer because there'll be far more stupid mistakes. On a typewriter, when you're nervous and you can't correct it, you think about it very carefully before you type. on a computer, you just go back and get it later. And you usually don't. That's from the typewriter to the word processor stage. But from the word processor stage to AI, the changes are going to be fundamental and remarkable.
And for everybody who wants to go and jump the book, once again, it's called The Complete Obsolete Guide to Generative AI. It's available at manning.com. And it's got a lot of humor. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to quote you on what you just described. The book says, "Let me give you some context. I'm a lot older than you might think. I wrote my first book on sheets of paper using a pen. It may have been a very old technology, but it was solar powered. Translation, it was only useful when I opened the window or turned the lights on." That's the kind of humor that you're going to get in droves when you read through David's book. David, thank you so much. This was an absolute pleasure. Hopefully, next time we speak, we are both not replaced by AIs. Or maybe we are, and it's actually going to be a better conversation.
Or maybe we are already. How do you know these aren't avatars and deep fakes? But I think you're real. I'm fairly confident I'm real. And I, as a real person, I enjoyed this conversation, and I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes.
And so did I, at least in this version of the simulation. Thank you. See you next time.
Take care. Thanks a lot. Thanks.